From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, October the 4th, 2019. And we have an interesting show lined up for you this morning. In the first hour, we're going to be talking about an acknowledgement this week by state officials that the Vermont will not meet its 2028 goal for reducing carbon emissions from our state by 50% from 1990 levels. That was supposed to happen by 2028. Instead, we've been heading in the wrong direction on this. By 2015 or so, I am told the state was actually had increased its carbon emissions from 1990 levels by about 16%, I believe it was, and indications are still going up a little bit. So we're going to be talking with a range of folks about that. First off with Elizabeth Gribkoff. She's an environmental writer with vtdigger.org and wrote the story this week about this this development, this announcement from state officials. In the in a little bit, we're going to be talking with Peter Walk, who's Deputy Secretary of Natural Resources. We'll add him into the conversation, as well as Joey Miller with the Vermont Natural Resources Council. They'll be joining us to give their thoughts about this this issue of Vermont's carbon reduction goals, and easy for me to say. And so this should be an interesting conversation, and one that is definitely worthwhile. In the second hour of the program, we're going to be looking a little bit more at the whole impeachment imbroglio in Washington. There's a lot of developments going on, a lot of pushback coming now from the Trump administration and its defenders, people trying to point at Adam Schiff and the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Did he have advance word of the inspector general, or I'm sorry, the inspector general complaint, the whistleblower complaint going to the inspector general. That's what I'm looking for. Did he have advance word of the whistleblower complaint going to the inspector general? If he did, is that a problem? That's another question I think is worth asking as well. So we'll delve into some of the latest developments on impeachment in the second hour of the program, and hoping to get some listeners weighing in there. What do you folks think out there about how is this playing in living rooms and bar rooms and elsewhere across Vermont? What do folks think about all the developments out of Washington in the last 10 days or so on that front? All right, well, let's get right into this climate change discussion then. First off, Elizabeth Gribkoff joins me on the phone from Montpelier this morning. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Hi, Dave. Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Give us a sort of a recap of your story here. What developed on the climate change front this week in Vermont?
Well, so the main news, as you kind of alluded to, was that Vermont, it's no secret that Vermont's emissions have been rising in recent years for people who follow this stuff. But I just really wanted to see whether, you know, state leaders and leaders in the legislature thought Vermont would be able to meet its pretty ambitious climate goals to reduce emissions 50% below 1990 levels by 2028, which actually is more than a 50% reduction, since, as you say, our emissions have been rising in recent years. And a few of these state leaders were saying, no, it's really not realistic. So that was kind of the main new thing, I guess, in my story.
Yeah, what is the sense out there? I mean, this is codified in state law. You know, Vermont passes a law, and I think your story said 2007. Saying that we were going to have this goal of a 50% reduction in 2028 from the 1990 level. And I don't know, is there sort of a group shrug out there? Is that what's going on?
I mean, I think, I think the state passes a lot of goals into law that don't always get met. And that's in part what I discuss in my article, is there's this debate about some other New England states have passed something that's referred to as the Global Warming Solution Act, and it actually kind of turns these goals more into mandates. So there's been some debate in the legislature about that. But, I mean, that is part of the thing. It's like, yes, it's in law, but also it's just a goal, so there's not really a lot of teeth to it.
And you do have to ask then, I guess, why bother? What's the point of setting a goal if it is so likely. I think folks, some folks had an inkling maybe from the very beginning here that this was ambitious to the point of not going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's, I think maybe that's fair. And, you know, part of it is that Vermont has done a pretty good job, as I discussed in my article, kind of greening up its electric sector in terms of, you know, utilities having fairly renewable power supplies, a lot of efficiency work in the electric sector, but then getting the reductions where we would need to be getting them now from transportation and from building energy efficiency, that's a lot harder. So that's sort of where I think where the state is putting more energy in at this time, but where it's also just harder to get those reductions.
Yeah, and one of the questions I have about this, I know that those are the big three, electricity, transportation, yeah, and space heating. Let's break those down a little bit. Which one is the worst offender when it comes to kind of defeating this goal? Is it transportation that's really adding emissions?
Yeah, it is transportation, and that's where we've seen the most increase as well. But I think it's a little over 40% of the state's emissions now, I believe. So that's definitely the biggest chunk.
And break down the other two. What are the? I mean, I gather 40% of maybe a plurality. Then what is it? 30 apiece for electricity and heating, or
no? So actually, yeah, I'm looking right now. It's 43% for transportation, about 24% for, you know, heating use or heating, and then only actually 10% for electricity.
10% for electricity. So
yeah, so Vermont actually has other states, like nationally, it's more like 30% for electricity.
Yeah, yeah,
so, yeah.
And boy, you know, I tell you, this stuff isn't easy. And I'll give you one example from the comments on your story this morning. A person named John Kyle writes in about something called, sulfur hexafluoride, which apparently is used in a lot of electrical switching equipment and is a very, very potent greenhouse gas. And his concern here is that if that gets into the environment, it has 28 times the global warming potential, just as a matter of chemistry, really, than CO2. So is this a case of, you know, two steps forward, three back or something, or what are we doing here?
Yeah, I mean, I think I admit I don't know a ton about sulfur hexafluoride, so I'm not going to speak to that specifically, but it is definitely true that there's, I think a lot of the focus is on CO2 emissions because that's, you know, what our far, you know, biggest source of emissions are. So that's what's contributing kind of the most to climate change. But then there's things like, you know, methane emissions in the shorter term are far more potent. And then there's these other greenhouse gases that, you know, maybe like this one that also have that, are just far more potent, even if they're released in smaller volumes. So it's, you know, and there's been, I guess the methane kind of comes up with natural gas, which that's actually in some ways what's, you know, helped to reduce emissions from some of the New England gases, switching out, you know, oil powered plants over to natural gas for electricity. Yep. But then there's concern about, oh, is it, you know, is there methane leakage from that? So it's really complicated. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's people need to be aware of the difficulty here that, a lot of this stuff is, as you say, it's complicated, and it's not a matter of simply, and this is probably a bad metaphor in this context, but flipping a switch and saying we're going to change our climate, our energy policy now to reverse climate change or whatever, because so many of the things that get tried end up having their own issues out there. I mean, I've heard a lot of people like hydropower, for instance, as a allegedly carbon neutral source of energy. But then if you read the scientific studies, I saw one a few years ago indicating that actually when reservoirs rise and are lowered again, which is a very frequent feature of hydroelectricity, you end up with a lot of speeded up decomposition along the banks of the reservoirs.
Yep.
And that decomposition is doing what? It's releasing carbon right. into the atmosphere. So it seems as though there are no simple. I don't mean to be utterly discouraging here either, and say that there's nothing we can do. But I think that people need to be aware of these mitigating effects of you make an effort to, you know, as I say, two steps forward and three back or something, or you gotta find a solution that's three steps forward and only two back, I guess.
It's definitely, as you said, it's definitely complex. And there's a difference with hydro. You have, you know, those, what you're kind of referring to, those really pretty large dams, like what Hydro Quebec has, versus smaller, what are called run-of-the-river dams,
yep.
which, you know,
yep.
wouldn't have, but yeah, it's so it really depends on, you know, what kind of hydro, and that's kind of true of everything.
Yeah, the devil's always in the details on this stuff.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
really kind of to an amazing degree. I mean, because we get into technology and science very quickly, and I mean, the other story you hear is that nuclear power, you know, people advertise it, especially nuclear lobbyists advertise it as being emissions free, and then you realize that most of the fuel, there was a plant in Kentucky called the Paducah plant, which made fuel for the commercial reactors around the country.
Mm-hmm.
I read not long ago that plant had a power demand that would go up to about 3,000 megawatts, which is more than triple Vermont's load. The load of the entire state. And I mean, you have to ask yourself, okay, so this is Kentucky. Where are they getting their electricity?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you bring up nuclear, because I think that's something that historically, obviously, there's been a lot of pushback from the environmental community over nuclear. And, you know,
yep.
for Vermont Yankee, we saw that certainly. But there's some people now saying, and some people kind of, I guess, on the left or in the environmental community that are concerned that without nuclear, it's going to be really hard for us to drastically, for our country to drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So that's kind of been an interesting turn there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the debate, although does Vermont tell a story there in the sense that we have the most progress we've already established now that we've made in terms of controlling greenhouse gas emissions is in the electricity sector, and we did that while we closed our nuclear plant.
Yeah, though, I mean, our emissions, and I confess that I don't know exactly what led to this, but they, from 1990 to 2000, there was this decline, like pretty steep decline in our greenhouse gas emissions from the electric sector. And then they did start rising some again.
Since the closure of Vermont Yankee in 2013.
Well, I've definitely seen that in comments on my articles, but that's actually not really accurate, because Vermont Yankee closed in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And emissions have gone up a little bit since then, but not, there was a more significant rise before then. So I think that's a little bit overly simplistic. I've seen the people draw a correlation between, our emissions have been going up in recent years. That's also when Vermont Yankee closed, but that's not really what's been driving our emissions going up as a transportation sector, not electricity. So that's,
And of course, the other narrative that's still out there was all the greenies and the environmentalists and Governor Shumlin, et cetera, who closed Vermont Yankee. It was low gas prices, wasn't it?
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, that's really what controls a huge installation like a nuclear plant and its economic future. It's rarely the regulators. It's more often what else is out there for people to get their electricity from. And natural gas was coming on strong.
Right.
A lot of the fuel available, very, very cheap. Guess what? Let's build another gas plant. Wanted to introduce my two other guests we're going to bring into the conversation. Elizabeth stays with us, and we're going to add in Joey Miller. Joanna Miller is with the Vermont Natural Resources Council. And Joanna, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Good to be here. Thanks, Dave.
And Peter Walk is the Deputy Secretary of Natural Resources. He has been a key player in state government on climate policy. And Peter, thanks for getting here this morning as well.
Thanks, Dave. Always a pleasure to be with you.
And I just want to describe a major blow against climate change this morning. Joey and Peter actually carpooled up from Montpelier to get together. And so that's always a good thing. And I do want to talk about some of the transportation sector in Vermont, because that seems to be a key issue in an area where emissions have been growing, and it certainly seems like there's a lot more traffic on the roads these days in Vermont too. I don't know whether that's just my imagination or if there are some statistics to bear that out. But first, I wanted to return to our conversation before the break a little bit about the electricity sector, and just ask Peter Walk, ask you if you are pleased with the degree to which the electricity sector has been able to reduce carbon emissions. Can we squeeze it harder? How are we doing?
So that's a good point. I think the one thing to note is that we have made progress, and it's been really progress across the sort of Northeast region as we look at the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which has been a cap and invest program that's been in place since 2009 that has really reduced emissions across the region. And we just got word yesterday that Pennsylvania wants to now join that group. And to put that into perspective, Pennsylvania's overall electric power production emissions are equal the entire rest of the region combined. So the what that does to the market is make options for reductions significantly. So they have lots of coal power plants that are not cost effective at this point. So switching them out for cleaner facilities is going to be easy, and it's going to be therefore less expensive for us to get emissions reductions across the region, which is really important.
And talk to me a little bit about, is there an acid rain reduction effect here too? Because Pennsylvania is sort of upwind from Vermont, or at least Western Pennsylvania certainly is. Are we going to see some reduced emissions or acid rain constituents flowing in from the Southwest?
We would to some extent, except for we've largely dealt with the sources of acid rain because there's technology in place at most of those coal power plants now to scrub the emissions that are coming out for the main components of acid rain. So we've seen a lot of sort of biological regrowth within our lakes and ponds that's encouraging to see, and so yes, we will overall, but that's been a problem that has somewhat successfully been dealt with, and one that we're encouraged by. I will say that it was the first instance in which a pollution cap and trade program really was seen in the U.S. and was incredibly effective, was the acid rain program.
And talk to us about the REGI, because I think a lot of our listeners are very vague on, and I'm a little bit vague myself on exactly how this works. What do you mean by a cap and trade program? This thing in place since 2009. What has it done? How's it worked?
Sure. What essentially the way it works is that instead of telling every electric generator in the region that everybody has to reduce by such and such an amount, so 25% over the next 10 years, whatever that number is, we say collectively as a group, they need to reduce by 25%. And we allow them to figure out, let the market in between them figure out who can do it most cost effectively. And that's really the strategy, because some facilities are at the end of their useful life and are getting ready to be reinvested in new technology anyways. And so those are already planned and therefore very cost effective. There'll be some that are not at the point in their useful life where making those investment makes sense. So there's a number of changes that could take place, and there's technology that comes online that makes things cheaper. And so we let the market figure out where that should do it. And it works well for greenhouse gases in the event that we have, because it's such a global problem, the specific point source of greenhouse gas emissions doesn't matter as much.
So when you talk about taking plants offline that are late in their useful lives, let's say, it's a little bit like the decision making process a homeowner might go through when they say, do I go out and buy the more energy efficient refrigerator right now, or is the fridge that I have in my kitchen got a good 10 years left on it, and should I wait?
So that's exactly the conversation that we're having pretty much in all energy using technology, right? Is that we as a state, we as a society need people to be thinking about their next major purchase, right? Whether it be their next vehicle or their next heating system, their next TV or refrigerator, all of those things that use energy in a meaningful way. There are choices that are available that use less or different types of energy that we'd like people to use. But we do understand fully that it's really hard to see anybody making that transition on their own before that thing is coming to the end of its useful life.
Because it has to make sense economically as well as... Joey, let me bring you into the conversation here. We only have a minute or so to go, but I want you to quickly just answer this question. Are we squeezing hard enough on Reggie on the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or should we have set the targets lower?
I mean, Reggie, as Peter just said, is a really successful program, and there's potentially more to do, but it's my hope and that we focus more in the other places where we haven't made nearly as much progress. And that's what Elizabeth highlighted earlier for folks, is that it's really our transportation and thermal sector, how we heat and cool our buildings, that we really need to focus on. And I think Reggie's a successful model. Vermont has benefited from that program, saving ratepayers, you know, a lot of dollars, taking the revenue raise from that program and reinvesting it in weatherization, helping people stop wasting heat and energy by tightening up their homes. So my focus would be on other sectors.
We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News and be back in a couple of minutes with more of the Dave Graham Show. I want to bring Elizabeth Gripkoff back when we do and talk a little more, whole range of issues here on energy and climate change, etc. We'll be back, folks.
Fall. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back talking about an excellent Vermont Digger story this week. Sort of pointing out the fact that I think something everybody kind of knew in the back of their minds if they're studying the issues, but something that needs to be pointed out from time to time. Vermont is not on track to meet its goal of 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2028. That was pointed out for us this week by Elizabeth Gripkoff, VTDigger.org, their environmental and energy writer. Elizabeth's on the phone with us this morning. I've got two guests in the studio here helping to flesh this topic out, and they are Peter Walk, the Deputy Secretary of Natural Resources for the state of Vermont, and Joanna Miller of the Vermont Natural Resources Council. And Elizabeth, unfortunately, has only a few more minutes she can spend with us this morning. She's got to get off to other stuff pretty soon, but wanted to give you a crack at a question maybe for Peter, Elizabeth, and or Joey, if you want to run it by Joey as well. But let's talk a little bit about a new approach to transportation that has some similarities to that Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in electricity we were just talking about. What did you have in mind that you might want to ask Peter about this?
I'm just wondering, I know that there was an update this week with this initiative called the Transportation Climate Initiative that Vermont's part of, and it's kind of a similar effort to Reggie, but for transportation emissions. And I was just wondering, Peter, if you could maybe talk a little bit about how that would work and where you guys are at in negotiating that.
Sure. Thanks, Elizabeth. So yes, the Transportation and Climate Initiative has actually been a group that's been talking, a group of states that's been talking since 2010, so shortly after Reggie was formed, to see if there is a regional approach to reducing emissions in the transportation sector that would be effective and that all the states would be interested in. At the end of last year, Vermont signed on to a statement where we said we would spend the next year really digging into the specifics of what a program might look like so that we could have the facts or at least the modeling data to be able to say what we think is going to happen and what we think the costs and benefits to Vermonters might be. We had been talking at largely a theoretical level, and all of the states determined that we really needed the detail in order to be able to make a valid conclusion. And that's the direction that I've gotten from the governor, is to go out and see what the best possible program is for Vermont. And then we need to come back. We needed to have a discussion about whether or not it is a good solution for Vermont. There will be costs. There is benefits along the way, not just in greenhouse gas emissions reductions, but in helping people make those transitions to new technologies. Hopefully, you know, at the point where they're making those new purchases, there's big purchases. But we're really in the, we need the detail, and that's what the direction that I've been given by the governor to go and get. And so the announcement that we put out this week from the region is really about sort of what do we know about what the states have determined we're focusing on at this point, and then what is the timeline for further information released to the public, and how are we going to further engage with the public. So we're looking at a December timeline for putting out what will be known as essentially a draft memorandum of understanding, which is what the sort of the piece of legalistic paper that would bind the states in this agreement. And it would be a draft. It would be opportunities for the public to comment on the pieces of it, on what it means, on the various components of it. And at that point, the states would really take it up in earnest to determine whether or not it is the appropriate option for them. And that's not guaranteed. Transportation is a lot more challenging than the power production sector is, because there are, we are all generators rather than a small number of large power plants. And so where we put that point of regulation matters, where how we deal with the various impacts of the program are much more complicated given the way the power moves and the way the fact that it's simply we people are buying gas in many different places and the distributors are buying fuel in different places. And so it is a much more complicated endeavor that we need to have a full conversation about in Vermont to see whether it's appropriate for us.
And Elizabeth Griebkopf has been a guest on the phone here on the Dave Graham Show for the first 40 minutes of the program this morning. Elizabeth, I am going to let you go because I know you got to get somewhere, but I really appreciate you joining us this morning. And thanks for your good work on this story. I mean, I think it raises some important issues that obviously are fodder for discussion as our discussion this morning is proof. Thanks for your good work.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Dave.
Alrighty, we'll talk to you soon. I'm going to continue on with this discussion, though, with our guests, Joanna Miller of the Vermont Natural Resources Council, and Peter Walk, the Deputy Secretary of the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources. We actually have a caller on the line. Let's hear what Bob from Burlington has on his mind. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Yes, it seems there's one approach that hasn't been addressed that could be taken that would deliver very good reduction resulting from the transportation sector, and at the same time not cost anything, and that is to enforce the current speed limits on the state highways and on the interstate. That would achieve a reduction of gas consumption of 15% to 20%.
It might cost me a couple speeding fines, but other than that...
other than that, that's about it. And it would take about 3 minutes more to get from Burlington to Montpelier, driving 65 instead of 80.
3 minutes more. Who's got 3 minutes to spare these days?
That's a small price to pay for a big reduction.
Wow. How much of a reduction do you estimate? Or does?
Well, again, it's roughly the car efficiency drops off at a speed in excess of 55.
Mm-hmm.
The state speed limit of 50 is right in the sweet spot, and you can get a 20 to 25% reduction compared with driving faster. Now, on the interstate, I think it's safe to say if you're going 65, people are doing 70, 75, and 80 going past you.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are going to see anywhere from like about a 9 to 10% if they're doing 70 to closer to 20% if they're doing 80. So, you know, a big reduction there if those speed limits would be enforced.
Wow. Okay. Well, thanks for the call, Bob. Interesting thought. Let me ask Peter Walk. You are not the Commissioner of Public Safety for the state of Vermont. I'm sure you're glad about that most days. Would we see significant transportation efficiency from actually observing our speed limits?
We would see transportation efficiency from a number of different changes, from having well-maintained vehicles, driving the speed limit, all of those things. I think the cost of enforcement of our speed limits to get to the point where everybody's doing it would be significantly higher than the budget, certainly the budget of public safety could currently bear. And so that's a it's not a free, you know, enforcement isn't free.
Yeah, that's a good point. You have to hire probably more troopers out there on the roadsides. Joey Miller, how fast did you guys go when you were coming up here this morning?
Peter drove very safely and the speed limit. But I think the point that the caller makes is important, which is to say that there are lots of small things that we could and should be doing. I think, and Peter just noted some of those other small but important things. But the bigger point for me is that we also need to be doing big things, and thinking more holistically and having an approach related to reducing emissions in the transportation sector and the thermal sector in a way that we don't. I mean, you heard earlier and you know well, I think your listeners probably know well, that we've made a lot of progress in the electric sector.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not by accident. We have really good programs and regulatory tools like REGI. We've had net metering. We've had a renewable energy standard that has requirements that our utilities are obligated to meet. So I think the point for me is we don't actually have those same tools in the transportation and thermal sector. So it's exciting that, you know, the state is pursuing this transportation and climate initiative. We need tools like that. I hope we actually put our shoulder behind a strong program and one that is science-based and is going to be significant in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector. But we're going to need to do more than that as well. And in a state that imports 100% of the fossil fuels that we use, actually reducing our consumption keeps more money in the state, puts more money in Vermonters' pockets. So I think, you know, for me, it's we should be doing the small things. We also need to be doing the big things, and we need public policy that supports that.
Here's one big thing, Joanna Miller, a carbon tax. Do we need a carbon tax in Vermont?
I mean, that's a conversation that has been happening for a while. It's politically, unfortunately, a non-starter because it's working well in many other jurisdictions across the globe where people have had long time carbon pollution taxes enacted and their economies are doing well and their greenhouse gas emissions are going down. But unfortunately, that's not on the table at the moment from my perspective, because it could be well structured and equitable. And we worked with low income Vermonters and businesses to ensure that the policies that were introduced in the legislature actually were fair for those who already carry a high energy burden. So, but politically, that's not happening. So I think we need to be focusing elsewhere.
Peter Walk, why is that not happening politically?
That is because I think it's a reflection of what people are willing to bear in terms of cost. I think there's always a balance between any policy action and the costs that are associated with it.
And this is obviously, it has been a hot political potato in recent years, and the Democrats in the legislature who support a carbon tax are they're mainly shying away from it these days because they get so much heat from critics about this. Well, Joey, you want to?
Well, one thing that I think is important is like thinking about cost holistically, because we're paying the price of putting this problem off already, and that's manifesting in Vermont state budgets and certainly in our federal budgets and what taxpayers are paying for climate exacerbated catastrophes. And that's only going to increase. So I think thinking about costs, not just in short term cost, sort of equations, but in longer term thinking about how do we move people off of fossil fuels that are doing damage to our planet and save people money over the long term, too.
Got to get some callers in here. Let's go to Gary in Georgia. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. I got a little question here. Being a small city, I know a little bit, you know, helps a long way, but our surrounding cities like Montreal and Michigan and New York, aren't we kind of bucking our heads against this environmental thing with, fighting this, all the other big towns or all the other big cities? Is that why the state of Vermont is getting expenses to live?
Okay, thanks for the call, Gary. Good question. Let me put it to Joanna Miller. Joey, do you think the Do you think the state of Vermont is an expensive place to live because we have the environmental regulations that are bucking trends elsewhere?
I don't think so. I think the state of Vermont, you know, spends money on a lot of different things that Vermonters value. But I would say related to any potential costs related to energy, I look to our neighbors to the north, like in Quebec, where Montreal is. They have a Western Climate Initiative, a cap and invest program that covers all of their energy sectors, including thermal and transportation. And their, again, their greenhouse gas emissions are going down. Their population is increasing, and their economy is growing as well. So I think that, you know, it's, I just want to push back on any sort of misconception that doing well by people and their pocketbooks and our economy is necessarily at odds on doing the right thing when it comes to environmental protection and climate.
Certainly, if the Quebec economy is doing okay, it's despite the fact they have gasoline prices that are way higher than ours. Is that do you know what percentage higher they are these days?
I don't, but yep. I know a lot of Canadians that come down here, and I've luckily been up there to their beautiful country that are seem happy, and their economy's doing well, and mm-hmm. all is well.
Let's go to Bruce in Essex. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. Dave, you have to stop having these complicated subjects.
Yeah.
But anyways, and, you know, I've been in politics, so I realize that some things are political non-starters, which, is, given the challenges we face not only with climate change but habitat destruction and things like that, you know, is really, when you say it's things are non-starters, then that's sort of thrown up the white flag. I have had an exchange with internationally respected writer on the environment things. I won't mention his or her name, but he or she finished a letter to me recently. He said, "I'll believe the sincerity of conservationists so soon as they advocate rationing of all limited supplies, including, of course, gasoline." I'll admit that's politically a non-starter, but this is a very serious person making a very serious proposal. And here, when we faced World War II, we did it. You know, there was a black market. It was distorted. But there you go. We depend so much on a mobile environment, and we could start today doing that and start to make a big difference.
Rationing gasoline.
Yeah. And okay. I can't imagine either of two of your guests would ever support that.
Well, let me put it to them. Thank you for the call, Bruce. Interesting question. Peter Walk, you're a regulator. Can you imagine rationing gasoline as part of your portfolio?
So I will say the difference between World War II and now is that in World War II, we had an entire country that believed in the cause and the work that needed to be done and had ways in which they could contribute to the effort. Unfortunately, we're not there yet on climate change. We have still a subset of the population that is not on board with the work that we need to do. And so to force action in that way is going to lead to additional sort of pinballing in the political sphere that is not going to be helpful in terms of ultimate action. We need to help people make those transitions and get the ball moving so that people see their friends and neighbors driving different vehicles or taking different forms of transportation and see that it's part of the everyday life of people around them before they can really see that it's a viable option for them. And to force them into a structure is not going to work.
Divided population, one member of our population, that being the President of the United States, calls climate change a hoax. So there's some division right there. Let's go to Don in Elmore. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Dave. I'd like to echo what the fellow that called earlier was saying about better motor vehicle law enforcement in this state.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that we can do that, and I think do it better and save cost in the process, is by having at least 50% of the state police vehicles totally unmarked. Why do they need to be marked for traffic enforcement? That's like having a flag out there saying, "Slow down, I'm a trooper." You know what I'm saying? I'm sorry, but a stop sign in this state means nothing anymore. And speed? I'm not one of those people that necessarily thinks that speeding is a cause of a lot of accidents, but it certainly is a cause of a lot of accidents where people are speeding and they're inattentive. And I can't help but wonder if those two accidents over on 89 in Colchester this week aren't a good example of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But and perhaps some signage. But, I mean, seriously, the number of police vehicles we have seems to be adequate for the job. If we had an ample number of police, I understand the state police are down in employment, and I'm not sure that's a good thing. But then again, here in Lamoille County, we only have two troopers coming from Williston to service the county.
Well, you know, maybe I'll have to have somebody out for the Department of Public Safety.
I see them out there on traffic patrol sitting, but I mean, good God.
Yeah.
When they're easily identifiable, how good is that for traffic enforcement? I'm sorry.
Well, it does slow people down, for sure. I mean, it doesn't result in as many people getting tickets, so it's not as punitive, but it does. You definitely get a suggestion when you're driving along 89 and... you know, of course, when the trooper pulls me over and he says, "How fast were you going?" I said, "Well, the sign said 89. I usually drive a little faster on 91." Oh, I'm only kidding, folks. Don't worry about this. Anyway, Don, thanks for the call. I understand where you're coming from.
I hear what you say, Sam, but I still think when a trooper is out there driving in traffic in an unmarked car, he's going to catch an awful lot more people than he is if he's got a totally marked cruiser.
Got it. Okay. Thank you so much. And Nils from Duxbury, what's on your mind? Nils, are you with us?
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yep.
Thanks for taking the call. So I think the speeding conversation is great. I think you'll also find that the trucking industry will lobby until they're old and gray to not change the speed limits, and that's just a whole other story. My interest really with this conversation, and I've brought this up a lot, but many times, and it never gets anywhere, that is regional air travel and the lack of sensible rail travel in Vermont. When I say regional air travel, what I mean is getting a plane in Burlington to go to Boston or Albany or Buffalo.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a 3 or 4 or New York City, 300 or 400 mile radius, where if we had a
better
rail system, we wouldn't have to do that. And there's a million reasons why this makes sense. And whenever I bring it up, you guys and your guests always end up saying, well, it's regulated by the federal government, you know, yada, 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 yada. So the challenge is, how do we get the federal government to get off their butts and realize that we need to start shifting subsidies away from air travel in the
It's a great point, Nils. I appreciate it, but I've got to cut you off because we got to go to a top of the hour break here. Thanks so much for the call. Leaning harder on rail travel than air travel, certainly for short haul regional travel, is something that climate advocates have been talking about, and maybe one of these days it'll start to happen. We are in the last minute here before the top of the hour. I want to thank my guests very much. First, Elizabeth Gribkoff joined me this morning from btdigger.org. Joanna Miller of the Vermont Natural Resources Council. Peter Walk, the deputy secretary of the State Agency of Natural Resources. Thank all of you for coming in this morning. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Dave.
And we're going to go to some CBS News at the top of the hour, and we will be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back, and you know, we have a long history on this program of going to our talk media news friends at just after the 10 o'clock CBS news break here on the Dave Graham Show and WDEV. Right now, talk media news is taking a bit of a hiatus. We're trying to figure out their future with us, and we're not sure exactly yet what's happening there. Hope to have them back in the not too distant future, but that's still uncertain at this point. I've been getting a number of emails from listeners asking about that, and I just wanted to keep you all informed. Our friends, people like Bob Ney and Tom Squitieri, Ellen Ratner recently retired, but she was a mainstay for a long time, and a lot of folks still mention Michael Olesker, who hasn't been on with us for several months for the most part because he's gone to their afternoon shift, but we're trying to work on that, I guess, is the best I can tell you. I don't really have any other details aside from that, and we'll hope that sometime in the not-too-distant future we'll have our Talk Media News friends with us after the mid-show. I think it's an excellent punctuation mark on the program here. I really enjoy the folks. They're just really nice people and thoughtful and have lots of insights to share about the national scene out there, and it's always a good conversation, and we hope that it resumes here soon on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, but we'll keep you posted. That's the best I can tell you right now on this Friday morning, October the 4th, 2019. I want to open the phone lines and invite listeners to call in this morning and give us your thoughts. Obviously, the big story in the country for the last 10 days or so has been all of this talk of an impeachment inquiry into President Trump in Washington. Any number of developments we can sort of pick at to talk about, and we may actually. I'm working on getting a commentator from CBS News to come to rejoin us later in this hour for at least a few minutes and talk to us about what they're seeing and hearing on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in Washington on this stuff. But unclear yet whether that is going to work out for this morning. But we're checking into it and hope that. Hope that we can do something with CBS a little bit later this hour, as I mentioned. Meanwhile, I'm interested in what our Vermont listeners here are thinking about the impeachment inquiry in Washington. Is this a witch hunt, as the president describes it? Is it way overblown? Are there issues here that the Democrats need to worry about in terms of their own possible culpability or whatever on anything related to Ukraine? The Ukrainian government, overnight I saw a story indicating that they are going to at least audit the findings, I think is the way it was phrased in one instance, of their earlier investigations of Hunter Biden, the son of the former vice president and current presidential candidate Joe Biden. Hunter Biden was a member of Burisma, a gas company based in Ukraine, and really got enriched, apparently. One report said he made millions of dollars for his role as a board member of this company. Most U.S. companies that bring on board members, from what I understand, you can get a nice income off of it, but it's not usually in the millions of dollars. So you have to ask, well, what was happening there? Ukraine, the earlier stories we were getting out of this area of inquiry was that the whole matter had involving the gas company had been investigated in the Ukraine, and the Ukrainian prosecutors had determined that there wasn't much there. There wasn't any wrongdoing, and by Hunter Biden and or by extension his father, Joe Biden, the former vice president, and now of course the president of the United States. The whole impeachment story is turning on the pressure he is said to have brought and has acknowledged bringing on the Ukraine to the Ukrainian officials to try to reopen and further intensify their investigations of Hunter Biden and by extension Joe Biden. And of course the Democrats are looking at this and they're seeing a president of the United States who, by the way, just days before making this phone call to Ukraine demanding the intensified investigation, the reopened investigation, had cut off military aid to Ukraine. And so the question really comes down to, is it as simple as that? Is it a matter of the president calling up the president of Ukraine and saying, hey, please open this investigation that might hurt my political rival back at home, thereby using the levers a president has, military aid, U.S. foreign policy, just shining a friendly light from Washington on another country. All of those levers that the president has, was he using them for his own personal and political gain? That seems to be the crux of the matter in kind of the main impeachment question. But so many other questions have swirled up around it. And I'm wondering if any of the other questions, I'm sure there are listeners out there in Vermont who are following some of the various threads out there. Here's just one that I'll throw out there as an example and ask folks what they think about. Fox News has been really working on this story, this angle of the story. Apparently, before the whistleblower complaint came to the Congress in its official capacity from the Intelligence Community Inspector General, the whistleblower himself went to the House, an aide to the House Intelligence Committee, and said, "I have some information here that you folks ought to have." And the Intelligence Committee folks said, "Well, go through your own internal process first, talk to your own inspector general, and then if it comes to us in that channel, we'll look into it." But the administration, President Trump, has looked at that initial contact between the whistleblower and the House Intelligence Committee, and also an earlier statement that Mr. Schiff, Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, made that he had had no direct contact with the whistleblower, as being inaccurate or a lie, and therefore the president saying that Schiff is guilty of treason and needs to be removed from his job, et cetera, et cetera. Dee from Duxbury is on the line. Dee, what's on your mind this morning?
Hi. I can't remember the article written. I can't remember who wrote it, but the gist of it was maybe the legislators in Washington could get back to legislating. I mean, I think there's a lot of time, effort, energy. Speaking of energy, spent on the whole impeachment thing and the whole. I mean, I wonder if laws are being passed.
Well, actually, that's an interesting question, and one that I know the Democratic leadership in the House has been talking about this and saying that we do want to get back to legislation. It's been difficult. Even if there weren't any impeachment inquiry going on right now, it was a very, very slow process to try to get anything passed by the House. And then you'd have to get it through the Senate, which, of course, is in Republican control. The Republicans in the Senate have, all other things being equal, don't really want – first off, they don't generally agree with a lot of legislative initiatives of the Democrats, right? So House Democrats pass a bill, let's say, extending Obamacare, right? And the Senate Republicans say, no, we don't want to extend Obamacare. So we're not going to move that legislation. It gets bottled up, and so no legislation passes. You can say, well, you know, whose fault is that? Maybe the legislation was a good idea. Maybe it was a bad idea. It is not happening. So it was, I would say, before this impeachment stuff heated up, it was already a rather do-nothing Congress. Wouldn't you agree?
And I think that going back to class, maybe, and looking at passing legislation for we, the American people, mm-hmm. would be a good idea.
Yeah, I think that that the Congress, obviously, their primary role in under our Constitution is to pass legislation. Of course, both houses have to agree. The legislation has to go to the president. The president gets to decide whether to sign or veto or pocket veto, et cetera, the legislation. And so it's a process that is not all, it's sort of designed not to be super smooth all the time. They don't get to make policy changes the way the Chinese government can, but then that's a dictatorship. So right. It's a difference, yeah. Dee, I think you raise an interesting point, though. And obviously, I do hear from people in Washington that we think we can chew gum and walk and chew gum at the same time. I've heard some of the members of Congress say, and we can work on legislation. There's a lot of I've heard some chatter on the cable channels just the other night with somebody saying that back during the Watergate investigation in 1974, there was a host of legislation passed, even though, you know, there was this huge division in the country over that Watergate investigation and so on. And, gee, why can't we do this this time? And, I do think that the question has to be put both to I'd put the question right now primarily to Mitch McConnell in the Senate and just say, Okay, the House is sending you, has sent you quite a number of bills over the past couple of years, and or you know, certainly since last year when the 2018 election put the House in Democratic hands. The Democrats have been fairly ambitious about trying to pass legislation in the House. You got a hopper full of bills. What about it, Senate? And that would be an interesting question. I think some of what you're seeing also, frankly, D, is the media focus. I mean, people haven't been writing a lot about legislation and legislative battles because there's just all this other stuff going on. So that's a big part of it. But hey, thanks for the call. I got to move on. Let's go to Gene and Barry.
Good morning.
Hi, Gene.
Hello. Good morning. I think Trump is pretty well concerned about getting reelected. They haven't found anything on Joe Biden. Who's he going to go after next? Probably Elizabeth Warren?
I certainly wouldn't. Let's put it this way. It would not surprise me in the least if she got in.
She's pretty good, too. I heard her one evening here last week.
Yeah.
Where she was, I can't remember where she was, but boy, she knows her stuff, though, doesn't she?
are you surprised that she hasn't been investigated by Ukraine yet?
Well, because they haven't found anything with Biden, so because he's pretty concerned about getting reelected, but he's trying not to show it, they said, you know. But he's making it the point more by the things he's doing. He shows that he's really concerned. He'll probably go for Elizabeth Warren next.
Yeah, there's always Bernie Sanders in case Bernie starts, you know.
I'm wondering if Bernie's going to stay in.
Well, it's a legit question. Although let me ask you why, because you know Bernie made a big fundraising haul this summer.
I know he has.
Yeah.
He's pretty well ahead, but. Is Elizabeth Warren, is she still the number one, or is Biden?
I haven't seen the latest polling. I mean, the most recent polling I saw indicated that it looked like Warren had a narrow lead, Biden, and then Sanders. The three of them, though, seem Sanders to be third. Within striking distance of each other, don't they?
Yeah. Them three, I think it's going to be between them. Them three, anyway. I mean, them others are behind, you know, quite a bit anyway.
You know, the other thing you got to remember here is we're talking in October here of the odd-numbered year before the election. We haven't even seen the first caucuses or primaries yet.
No, we've gone over a year yet.
Yeah.
You're even going to vote, you know.
Yeah.
So a lot can happen between now and then.
Well, we'll know a lot more about the Democrats come you know, February or March, but right now... It's still, I just think it's still, frankly, way up in the air. So.
Well, yeah, that's what I was just going to say. It's up in the air. I agree with you.
Yeah. All right, Gene, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
You thank you.
Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. I'll be really quick here, though, but, you know, it's funny how people, like, point to Congress and why aren't they passing more laws instead of investigating our corrupt president? And a lot of these people I've heard before call in when, you know, under different... different iterations of this morning show and complain about why are they down there just passing all these laws. So, you know, listen, that's the first thing. I mean, this is BS, you know, to put it into polite initials. But let me tell you something else. Congress people, when they take their oath of office, their oath is to protect and defend the Constitution.
Yep.
It's not to pass laws. And their first and most important job is to make sure that we have a constitutional government.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So right now they are doing the single most important thing they can. They are rooting out a great evil and a huge corruption in our federal government. So I applaud them for, even if they put aside everything else, applaud them for what they are doing.
Got it. Okay, Rama, thanks for the call. Open phone line hour here on the Dave Graham Show. Listeners, you are more than welcome to call in and weigh in on any aspect of what you've been seeing in the national coverage on the impeachment story or really anything else you want to opine about. Let's go to Ruth in Sheldon. Good morning, Ruth.
Yes, I think it's ridiculous for the media to keep saying that this is a case where Trump wanted dirt on his political rival. I don't think President Trump is the least bit worried about Joe Biden being his political rival. Are you worried about that? Do you think he's going to win the Democratic primary?
I really don't know. I personally, I don't have a I don't really have a dog in that fight for myself. I'm kind of watching what's going on, and I mean, I do think from a point of view of kind of the form and function of government, you want your foreign policy decisions, your military aid to foreign country decisions made without consideration to whether that foreign country might help you out with an alleged investigation of a potential political rival. I mean, that just doesn't look, it's not a good look, I would say.
But that's what they keep saying, but this isn't the issue. I think Trump is trying to find out if Biden and Hunter Biden did something wrong, corrupt, and I think they probably did. And I don't like the way the media, it's gotten to the point that if Trump opens his mouth for any reason whatsoever, he must be impeached. That's what, as a watcher of the news, that's what I'm seeing. He can't say or do anything without somebody complaining that he must be impeached. He's the president of the United States. Why can't he say or do something?
Well, I think that's a very, very broad statement, Ruth. And
I know it, but that's the way I see it.
Yeah, I think...
This is what I'm seeing, and I'm also seeing a lot of people are not listening or paying attention to the news anymore because they're sick of all this. And I do not like CBS News. I was very disappointed when I heard they were going to sponsor your station because I've told you before, I don't get Fox News or any of that. I'm only getting my information from CBS and NBC, and I know they're lying to us.
Well, that is something that I think that I can't agree. I mean, I have to say they endeavor to tell the truth every day. Obviously, they know that they would lose their credibility, they would lose their ratings.
I think they have.
If they lose their credibility, they're toast.
I think they have lost their credibility.
Well,
and so hasn't the New York Times.
You know, the President Trump paid the Times quite a compliment the other day. He was talking about the Times. Times had a story about the about this question of Adam Schiff possibly knowing something about the Inspector General report before the whistleblower report, before the whistleblower actually transmitted the report to Congress, right? So he had this alleged advanced knowledge, and it would be, I think, a surprise to some conservatives to know that it was the New York Times. I mean, that story, and at least in President Trump's eyes and in the eyes of his supporters, makes Adam Schiff look bad. And I think people would be surprised to understand that it was the New York Times that broke that story. Remember the failing New York Times, the fake news New York Times, all of this. The New York Times is absolutely one of the worst enemies of the American people, according to the president, except when they write something he likes. Now the story is big, it's big stuff, and he's waving it around at a press conference.
Is it true?
Is the story true?
Yeah.
From what I understand...
How do we know if it's true or not?
Well,
anyways, I thought Adam Schiff did look ridiculous. I saw him in the hearings. He made a hypothetical question that had nothing to do with the case that made the president look really bad. And I think the media should have jumped on Adam Schiff for doing that. But they don't. They just jump on the president.
How do you know that Adam Schiff did that?
I watched him.
On where? The media?
Yeah.
Okay, so that means the media did convey that message that Adam Schiff did that. You just told me that they didn't.
No. No.
Ruth.
Adam Schiff did it.
Yeah.
I saw him do it. The media did not say he did it.
But you were watching the media when you saw him do that, right? You were watching, I assume, a TV station.
Well, why wasn't he criticized for what he did?
He's gotten a lot of criticism for what he did.
Yeah, okay. You win. You're always right.
I'm just telling you, I could point to examples if you want me to, but he's gotten a lot of criticism, including from the President of the United States, who has quite a media megaphone, I must say. Hey, Ruth, thank you for the call. Really, I don't mean to scare you off because I do appreciate...
No, believe me, don't.
Okay.
You aren't listening to me because you don't believe me, but I'm telling you the truth.
You're telling me the truth.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks, Ruth. Yep. So, I hope folks understand out there that occasionally I will banter with people, even debate people here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's not because I'm not listening. It's because I'm trying to basically counter some ideas, maybe to just get into exchange of thinking here and get people to perhaps expand their minds. I love expanding my mind. It's one of the reasons I love the calls I get from people like Ruth and others here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. I think it's a good give and take, and I don't think that that there's any need for me not to listen to people. I try to listen to people, and I can pretty much recount for you right now if anybody wants me to call us up and ask what Ruth just told us, and that's because I was listening. So I don't know, folks. Sometimes it's a mystery. Life is a mystery here. And 244-1777 is the toll-free number. I'm sorry, that's the local number here in Waterbury. And the toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. Call us up. Let us know what you think. Is Adam Schiff a bad actor because he allegedly had advanced information about this whistleblower complaint before it got completely made official last week? Here's a New York Times report on this. Schiff got early account of accusations as the whistleblower's concerns grew. And basically, the story talks about how this whistleblower, who's still been not identified, was working within the bureaucracy in the intelligence community, trying to get a word to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, trying to get word to the senior counsel at the CIA, and say, hey, there's a problem here, folks. We should look into this. And felt that as though that message might be buried. It might just be ignored, or he might actually get some internal retaliation. Decided to go to the House Intelligence Committee and give them some word about this. And this is in advance of the whole thing breaking last week. The fact that communication got made has Trump, President Trump, convinced that Adam Schiff is a traitor. So, hey, we need to go to some bottom of the hour news from CBS. A couple words from sponsors. Mary from Randolph's on the line. We only got 20 seconds left or so I'm going to ask Mary to hang on. I love hearing from Mary. Don't be shy. Stay with us. So we'll be back in a couple minutes.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back. Open phone call hour, open phone line hour here on the Dave Graham Show. And actually, I've told we are going to be speaking with one of our CBS News correspondents, a special call to WDEV from the national network in just about 5 or 10 minutes, I believe. And I'm sure that'll be an extra bonus that is going to make me happen. I hope to provide some insights for our listeners as well. In the meantime, Mary from Randolph's on the line. Good morning, Mary.
Hi, good morning, Dave. Yeah, I always enjoyed listening to the different correspondents. They're right in the midst of it.
Yep.
And
yep.
It was an interesting perspective. So your previous caller was saying that she gets all of her news from CBS or NBC or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have cable, so I don't get any of that. But I do read. So I read. I go around. I get the Huffington Post online. I read that. CNN. I even jump over to Fox News to see what they're saying.
Sure.
It's just yep. interesting to see everybody's perspective. Another one is a British online, The Guardian.
Yes.
And that's always kind of an interesting perspective. You know, they, as you say, you know, they don't really have a dog in the race. So
yep.
they're just, you know, they're reporting. And it's so interesting. I think that, you know, the Trump supporters, they're arguing that the whistleblowers were incorrect and, you know, all of this. But didn't Trump just, in fact, fill it, that he announced to the reporters that not only should they investigate, should Ukraine investigate the Democratic vice president and Joe Biden and his son, but should China should also.
China should do that. Basically, every country in the world should investigate Joe Biden. I think that would make the president really happy.
It's really wild. I was just listening on VPR yesterday, too. There were two, I believe, New York Times reporters based in Washington, and they've written a book. And as they were on VPR, he was tweeting them and saying that it's all fake news. They spoke to 150 people, some of his former cabinet people that aren't there because it's a revolving door. People don't stay when they don't, you know, call his bidding. And it's a very interesting book. I couldn't tell you the name of it, I'm sorry to say, but it's about immigration, basically.
I see.
And that was a very interesting interview. So anyway, but that's, there's a lot of news out there that you can read, too.
You know, I just got to say about the New York Times is that it's either failing in all fake news or it is reporting big stuff. And these are the way the president describes it. Depending on the content of the story, if the story is favorable to him, it's big stuff. If it's not favorable to him, it's fake news. It's kind of an interesting. The New York Times is the New York Times day after day. I would say it only changes in the estimation of a certain individual who, and maybe his supporters, depending on whether they are writing favorably about the. Toward the president or not so much. So just
exactly. I'm sure if these two reporters from the New York Times had written a book all about, you know, all the great things that he's done, he would have been tweeting that, you know, they are highly intelligent, wonderful people, great book, you know, buy the book.
Yeah.
But it wasn't right. It wasn't his cup of tea. So
maybe anyway. The book would be called Perfect, just like the phone call. So
well, it was perfect. Yeah,
there we go.
Okay.
Mary, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Dale in Burlington. Dale.
Comment. Washington is such a mess. It just gets my stomach is hurting. But I did have one just quick question.
Yeah.
What happened to the talk radio news service? I noticed this week they're not on.
Talk Media News usually has been on our show since I've been doing this for about a year and a half. And one of my favorite features has been that daily report from Talk Media News. Their CEO recently retired. They got a new management down there. They're trying to figure out what kinds of services they want to offer to member stations around the country. WDEV will then have to figure out whether that still fits our program. So it's a little bit up in the air what's happening with Talk Media News, as I was explaining earlier. And I hope they settle back into the groove and are able to rejoin us in the near future. But I know it's something that I've gotten a number of emails about it. And let's hope that works out or something like it does, because I, too, have valued it very highly as a part of the program here. So I'm with you. That's all I can tell you.
I just hadn't heard the news, and I...
Yeah.
So I was going to call you yesterday, and I didn't get a chance. But
yeah, we so hope.
Thank you for filling
me. We hope
me
the
in.
Talks work out. We'll see what happens. That's all I can tell you.
Beautiful. Okay. If not, just have Bob Ney move to Vermont and be a co-host.
Do a freelance thing or something. Yeah, maybe we'll have to do that.
No, have him move to Vermont. He could be your co-host.
Maybe you could sign up for that $10,000 grant from the state to move here or something.
There you go. You got it.
Thanks for the call, Dale. And the Dave Graham Show, I think, is about to be able to hook up with one of our CBS News correspondents. I believe it's going to be Steve Dorsey joining me this morning. And he's a veteran CBS newsman, has been covering any number of national stories. You hear his voice all the time on the top of the hour and bottom of the hour breaks when we go to CBS News. He's a terrific crackerjack reporter, and I believe he is going to be with us very shortly here. On the Dave Graham Show, we're going to talk to him about a couple of good questions about impeachment, I hope. And here he is, Steve Dorsey. Thanks for joining me.
It's great to talk to you.
And CBS News, I really appreciate you folks doing these two-way, offering these two-way interviews to us. And I wanted to check in with you about the latest developments on impeachment. It looks like now, do I have this right, that Ukraine is actually talking about, okay, we're going to re-review the review of the earlier investigation of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden?
Yeah, I think Ukraine is maybe bending to the pressure building from the Trump administration as it continues to point out what it believes are the corrupt activities that the Biden family took part in Ukraine and also China, according to the Trump, according to the president yesterday, and possibly in other countries.
Now, let's talk about leverage for a moment. The military aid has still not been forthcoming to Ukraine, right? $390 million or something in that ballpark?
Yeah, well, there's some military hardware that the State Department has approved and that the Pentagon's aware of called Javelins, and that's on the way to Ukraine. It's cleared most of the official channels. So it looks like, I don't know if that's the full amount, but it looks like they'll at least be getting something to get started.
And that looks like it's going to be happening. What about leverage over China? Is that tied up in the trade talks, or what is?
Well, it could be, mainly because we don't know. We know that the president had a recent call with Xi Jinping, the president of China, and that's being treated the same way that many of these other high-level calls are being treated, and that's it's classified in a very secure system.
Yeah.
We don't know what the president has asked of China or any other country just yet. We do know he has talked about this, the Russia investigation with Australia's Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, and possibly Boris Johnson in the UK. So it's not unlikely that he would do the same with other world leaders.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if he thinks it works in one place, why not more? One question I have is there any evidence at all? I mean, Hunter Biden at least presumably had been in Ukraine some to serve on the board of this Burisma gas company. Has he been to China?
The president says he's taken millions from China. I don't think it's clear the extent to which Hunter Biden may have had a role in China, but certainly the Biden campaign is saying that this is wholly inaccurate by the president, and he's using this to attack his political opponent, and it's an abuse of power.
I tell you, millions from China, millions from Ukraine. I'm starting to get annoyed with my dad for never having run for vice president. But
or any foreign leader position. Certainly you and I, most folks, don't have any foreign business dealings.
That's true.
So it's hard to even imagine the kind of world that these people live in. It's strange.
I also wanted to ask about this Adam Schiff matter, because he allegedly had contact, or his committee staff had contact, with the whistleblower sometime earlier than the whole thing unfolded last week with the official transmission of the documents and so on. Is that a problem for Adam Schiff?
You know, I don't think we've really seen much from that confirmation, because the House Intelligence Committee says that they were approached by the whistleblower before that official letter was sent to Adam Schiff for guidance on how to submit a whistleblower complaint.
Yeah.
They say that's standard by both Republican and Democratic-led committees, and that there was no direct contact with Adam Schiff.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as a kind of thing, and it might be like the DMV, where you go to window B, and right. And they say, oh, you got to stop at window A first, you know?
Sure, sure. I mean, and you know, how do you submit a complaint about the president without knowing how to do it? I think it's reasonable.
It seems like it would be a reasonable thing, but of course the president is trying to cast the worst possible light on it. Adam Schiff, Shifty Schiff now, and guilty of treason, needs to be impeached or something himself. I'm not sure, but there we go. Well,
so what is reasonable in this day and time? That's the other thing that we're considering, because we're talking about things that aren't very common.
Unprecedented would be another word.
Unprecedented.
Yeah. Well, Steve Dorsey, I really appreciate you checking in with us this morning. Interesting insights from your end of the situation. And stay on the beat down there. You're all doing great work.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you.
All righty. Hey, folks, I wanted to go back to our open phone lines here on the Dave Graham Show. We have an opportunity for listeners to call in and weigh in. Is Adam Schiff... Is there any fault here to be found with the chair of the House Intelligence Committee for apparently his committee staff got some word from the whistleblower ahead of time that something was coming. And they said, well, you need to go through channels, the executive branch channels, which included obviously the report to the inspector general of the intelligence community. This this whistleblower we see reported many times now over the last week or so, a CIA employee, so a person definitely working within the rubric of the intelligence community in the United States of America. And the whistleblower goes to the House Intelligence Committee and says, I have some information. And they said, well, make sure you cross all your T's and dot your I's and mind your P's and Q's and get it to the right channels in your own organization and your own superseding organization, even the overall intelligence community inspector general. And then after all that, we'll talk to you. So again, it may have just been a case of, I think that metaphor of going to the DMV and being told you need to go to window A before you go to window B might actually work in this case. It's just that's all speculation on my part. If somebody else out there has a different theory for the role of the House Intelligence Committee staff and or the role of the House Intelligence Committee chair, Adam Schiff, in that early communication from the whistleblower, please call us up and share it. I may get my own eyes opened here. You never know. Stranger things have happened on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Mary from Randolph called a little while ago, and she was talking about this book by a couple of New York Times reporters, and we were both having a brain cramp, I think, where neither of us could remember what the book was, even though I think both of us knew what the book was. And then Mary very kindly went and found it online and emailed me just in the last few minutes, and it is it's called Border Wars. It's written by Michael Shear and Julie Hirschfeld Davis of the New York Times, and they are focusing on President Trump's immigration policy. And there was a meeting this past March that began, as so many had, with the President Trump fuming about migrants. But this time he had a solution. As the White House advisors listened astonished, he ordered them to shut down the entire 2,000-mile border with Mexico by noon the next day. The advisors heard the president's edict would trap American tourists in Mexico, strand children at schools on both sides of the border, and create an economic meltdown in the two countries. Yet they also knew how much the president's zeal to stop immigration had sent him lurching for solutions, one more extreme than the next. And one of the things the president suggested here, and according to these writers for the New York Times, is that folks showing up in trying to cross the border would have to be shot in the legs. And I must say, I remember there were in the scripture, there's a Bible passage that talks about Jesus referring to people who are going to be saved and talking about how I was a stranger and you took me in. I don't remember it saying I was a stranger and you shot me in the legs. Let's go to Ziggy from Newport. Ziggy, what do you think? Is that a good line? Should that have been in the scripture? I was a stranger and you shot me in the legs?
Well, you know, who is this? Pete Buttigieg? Buttigieg? Is that who I'm speaking with? It sounds just like him. He comes across very saintly also.
This is Dave Graham, and I just...
Yeah, I know it is.
Yeah.
Hey, big shout out to Ruth.
Uh-huh.
And her comments on, I don't like CBS, you know?
Okay.
Every time I hear, hi, I'm Deborah Rodriguez, you know, I always cringe. And I always think of the old joke that the comedians used to say when they were funny. Today, you're probably going to scold me when I say it, but it's an old joke. And I'm not going to say gal, I'll say person. I'll say, boy, I bet you that person's got a face for radio. A voice like that.
Uh-huh. Okay,
Ziggy. And I mean, okay, her point, your conversation, okay, let me get back to your first hour. Was terrestrial radio's really screwy for me today? It was fading in and out. But did the NASA report come up at all? I didn't hear it. Did I miss that? The NASA report on climate change.
Which one?
The one that came out this week.
It did not.
Yeah, I wonder why. Because they kind of like, I'm not sure, but I don't know the details, but it sounded to me, from a quick review that I heard, sounded to me like they debunked the idea that it was caused by man-made. It's something to do with solar activity and things like that. Maybe you should look into that. You know, I'd like to get a little different perspective. I'd like to hear Dave Graham say something nice about our president once in a while.
He has very nice blonde hair. How's that?
Not blonde. I don't know what it is. It's kind of like scary. Look, I think this bird.
Now you're the one picking on him, Ziggy. I said it was nice blonde hair. You're saying it's scary. What the heck?
It is. I mean, geez. He goes out there. The wind is blowing, and it's just right there. But you know, you just asked the guy from CBS in your talk.
Yeah.
And he said, he didn't know that if Hunter Biden went to China. It's been reported, but it's been reported that he was on Air Force Jet Number 2 with his father on trips to China, at least one trip. You know, I mean, and he says he doesn't know. I mean, I'm not crazy about CBS. Ruth's not crazy. You know, and as far as the headline news people going, I think that's good news. You know, let them go. Thank God.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call, Ziggy. It's always good to hear from you, and you definitely provide a somewhat unique perspective to the Dave Graham Show in WDEV, so thanks for doing that. Hey, 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. Just a couple minutes to go. We probably have time for one or maybe two more calls if listeners want to jump in. 1-877-291-8255 is the local, rather the toll-free number. Boy, I'm getting those reversed today for some reason. I think my synapses are not firing in the right direction in all instances here, folks. But I'm looking online, actually, because Ziggy was just saying there was something new out from NASA on climate change this week. I'm not seeing anything on Google right off the bat, but it's not that I'm doubting Ziggy. I'm just not coming up with it myself right now. And that is something I've got to point out here too, folks, is that your CBS news correspondent was on with us a little while ago. Steve Dorsey is a human being. As a human being, I'm sure he would agree with this. He doesn't have unlimited knowledge and unlimited information at his fingertips. And your host here on the Dave Graham Show, that would be me, also definitely does not have unlimited knowledge about. So the fact that we don't bring up something about a specific topic, like what did NASA say about climate change this week, may just be because we weren't aware that there was a new NASA report out about climate change this week. So I'm going to do a little bit of reading over the weekend, see if I can find such a thing. And if it's the case and there is some big news to report about climate change, I'm sure we can have some of our climate change experts back on the air next week and talk about it some more. And it's one of the great things, actually, about this talk radio format, I think, is that it's pretty open-ended. You know, a lot of our conversations are sort of a first rough draft of history, and we can always put on another coat of paint the next day if need be. If we can say, hey, it was an incomplete conversation yesterday in the following respects. And, of course, you know, one nice thing for us is it gets our listeners to tune in day after day and see if we can fill in more of the gaps or whatever in our joint knowledge of stuff. And I think it's a good process. I think talk radio has a lot of advantages that way in terms of its being a fairly fluid form of media and very interactive with our listeners and so on. So anyway, enough philosophizing from me for one day, because we are at about the top of the hour, and you can stay tuned after our program today for Bill Sayre Common Sense Radio, our midday news service. And we are going to be back on Monday with another edition of this program, the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. And I'll welcome you all to listen in then. And meanwhile, I hope you have a terrific Friday afternoon and weekend upcoming, folks. Talk to you Monday.